This is Brad Floyd. I'm interviewing. This is Brendan Floyd, man, reading Tom Swain about his musical experience here in Madison County. To start off, as a teenager, growing up in the area, I know you didn't grow up in Madison County, but growing up in the area, you got involved in music very early age, 14.
Right, yeah, I was about 14 years old.
Can you expand on what got you into that? Did you have an older brother who was influencing you? Did you start going to shows at a young age?
What? Well, I loved music. I went nuts on music. When the Beatles came around, I was like 7 years old and was a fanatic at 7 years old. I was outside of Busch Stadium. We were poor people, so I couldn't go to the show. But I stood out in the rain outside of Busch Stadium and listened to everybody scream. And, you know, later on, I just loved music and had zero talent.
Okay.
I tried to sing before, and at my best, I would have been below average. And I loved music too much to do that to it. So,
you mentioned this. You got into the behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Now, how did that work out? You became a bouncer working at clubs, and you just got into
Later on, when I was, you know, in my late teens, early 20s, I started working at concerts in St. Louis for Contemporary and Panther Productions. I worked security down there and started just watching the goings-ons of the music business, and it really just interested me a lot.
Okay.
And I just really enjoyed it, and started in clubs, you know, just clubs I hung out at listening to music, and I was always in Illinois, over here in Madison County, Alton, you know, just all over the whole area over here. There was a lot of clubs, Edwardsville, later on known to club there, and it was just interesting, you know. It was kind of wild back then. But the whole workings of it, I just loved the effect music has on people. And
so there's a very vibrant music scene here in Madison County.
Oh, yeah.
In the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, up through the 90s.
Okay.
The live music scene in St. Louis was a lot better than other cities. Like Minneapolis used to be real strong. I had more Minneapolis bands playing down here. It was like they had a big hair factory up there or something, and spandex, and they'd send them all down here, and because we had so many venues to work with that were open during the week and not just Saturday night places. So,
and so that start teetering off towards the 90s.
Yeah, the drunk driving laws, I think, had the biggest effect on the large clubs, because the larger clubs like Stages and Fat Cats and Grannies, places like that, depended on people coming, you know. They depended a lot on a St. Louis crowd also, along with Madison County.
So that's interesting. The drinking laws, you think,
yeah, it
correlated.
It got real politically correct to bust drunk drivers coming out of nightclubs, because, you know, they knew those people couldn't argue much. when they come out of there, they know they've had too much fun, and the police would sit on the side of the road and especially look for Missouri plates and pull them over.
Oh, wow.
Because even though we loved coming over here, I don't think the law enforcement loved the St. Louis people coming over here.
Now, there was a lower drinking age here.
Yeah, there was 19 when I was 19, which, of course, didn't really mean anything, because Illinois was also famous for door people with bad eyes that couldn't read driver's license real well.
So it was almost a free-for-all.
Yeah, if you had $3 in your hand, you were usually old enough.
So let's go right into the Fat Cats then. At 25, you opened a club here in Edwardsville called Fat Cats. Why do you see a need for a local club here in Edwardsville?
Well, actually, I got involved with it just a few months after it opened.
Okay.
Well, I got involved when it opened. I ran into some old friends of mine that knew me from back in 78 when I worked at a place called Rico's in Granite City, which was a very popular club, big club, real kind of rough rock and roll club.
Okay.
And I was
a bouncer. Little punk in there?
No, they were just, it was back in those days, they would have, like, on Wednesdays and Sundays, we had Beer Blast is what they called it. And it'd be $3.50 to get in the door for all the draft beer you could drink.
Wow.
So you know, obviously a lot of bozos showed up, and it was, they had need for people like me to help get them out of there. And
how old were you when you're doing?
I was, let's see, when I actually started working in there, I was probably 21.
Okay.
About 21, I guess. And, worked there for a couple of years, then got married and thought, oh, I need to get out of this and quit doing it. And then these guys tracked me down, and I was working for Madison County at the time as a supervisor and tax assessors in Madison County.
That's quite a change in career.
Yeah, it was, you know, I was in charge of the guys that went around and did the assessments. And it was a, during the time I was there, there was a lot of investigations going on and news channels chasing us and all that stuff. It was kind of exciting. And when I ran into these guys, were at the courthouse filing papers for their liquor license and stuff, they talked me into coming to work for them. And I was working at a little bar in Granite City, and I was working a second job to help pay for my kid, because my wife was pregnant and we didn't have health insurance. So back in those days, you know, it was a good idea to pay the kid off before they were born. And so I was working in a place, and I somehow convinced my wife at the time that it would be just the same thing if I went to Edwardsville and helped them work the door and was a bouncer there. And after 2 or 3 months, the two partners split ways, and I took over the one guy's that I used, that was a friend of mine that got me in there. I took over his part of it.
Okay.
And that was kind of a hard sell to my wife when I came home about 4 o'clock in the morning, half drunk once, and said, hey, guess what we bought?
So that must have been kind of exciting, though.
Oh, yeah. It was exciting, crazy, dangerous for a 25-year-old guy to own part of a rock and roll club and be running it. It was... yeah, my poor first wife, she would have probably liked to burn the place down and should have with me in it. But yeah, it was really cool. And we worked at that club, we worked with the bands a lot, and we encouraged bands to do original music, which, you know, nobody ever wanted to do in the St. Louis area at the time. Most of the clubs wanted nothing but copy material, and we had the majority of ours was, but we also encouraged, we had a group used to be out of St. Louis, and they relocated to New Orleans called the Sheiks, which were a real popular group back then, and they would come in town and play at our club for 3 nights in a row. Did nothing but originals, and we'd pack the place every time they were there.
Oh.
And we had another, like a new wave band called Fool's Face. Quite a few original groups that came in and actually did well. And we kind of had a different way of working. We worked with the bands, and we were strict with them, but we also treated them great.
Like, what do you mean? Like, what are some of the challenges you found working with bands at fat clubs? Like, what do you mean strict?
Well, they're real easy for them to have too much fun. When you become a local rock star, it's, you know, they party a lot, the drugs, alcohol, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they would try to, you know, get away as much as they could, take breaks for 45 minutes instead of a half hour, you know, sometimes just do stupid stuff that bands do. And I was real strict. Like, I used to have a sign in the dressing room that said, if you play, I agree with what the songs were, Cocaine, My Sharona, and something else, I'd fine you $50. It kind of became a joke somewhere out there. I think there's a picture of that sign in the dressing room that had all my rules on it and all my fines on it. They didn't. So, but most of them knew, you know, they knew how we treated them. We treated them like stars when they came in. We really took care of them. And in turn, I think we had, you know, a band would play there, would do one of their better shows there, just because of the vibe and the place and the way they were treated. And you know, they were treated well and paid well, and so, you know, they did a really good job.
Can you describe Fat Cats for me in the sense of, like, what did the building look like? How many people could be there? You guys took over for the granny?
The granary.
The granary.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was a granary, and it was actually a granary at one time.
Okay.
It was an old granary that they had converted. It had a lot of different levels. You entered in the basement, and in the basement we had a deli down there, and then we had, like, video games. And then you went upstairs, was the room which had, let's see, one, two, three, four different levels up there, and about five separate bars scattered around the place.
So this is large.
Yeah.
This is very large.
Yeah, it was a good-sized club. And our fire code was, I think, like 550, but several times we had like 1,500 in there one night when we got shut down.
Wow.
We had Leslie West playing there from Mountain.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had cars lined up and down 159. It used to be a little two-lane road at the time. And we had cars lined up all the way down there. And the, what was his name? Dickman was the chief of police.
Okay.
Him and the fire chief showed up and came in and started busting my chops about, we know there's way too many people in here, and what are you doing? And, you know, I said, God, I said, I just found it hard to turn people away. You know, I wanted to make money tonight, and just about had him calm down, and then my partner came down, who was a short guy with that Napoleon complex, and they were just about ready to leave, and then he walked down, and what the hell do you guys want? And he was a real smart-ass guy, and he told him, he said, well, if you notice, I got my shark coat on tonight. And as soon as he said that, I just cringed because I knew what was coming. He looked at him, he said, that's so you can kiss my ass. And so right then they said, shut it down. And we had to go up and stop Leslie West about halfway through his set and tell everybody they had to leave. So we fortunately got everybody out without a riot. So it was... But we put a lot of people in there.
Well, that leads me. What was the relationship with Fat Clubs with the overall community? Was the community excited to have you guys here?
No, I don't think so. The neighbors were definitely not excited. I felt sorry for them. We tried to patrol the parking lot as much as possible, but like I said, it was the early '80s. People were just nuts, and you know, after they come out of a rock and roll club, the neighbors complain, people having sex in their yards and urinating in their bushes and, you know, a little party going on out there. And so I don't think a lot of the locals were real thrilled about us, the establishment, but we did contribute a lot of tax money because, you know, a lot of money went through there. And, but the, you know, and they also seen it. We had a large St. Louis crowd. And they, you know, they were never crazy about all the St. Louis people coming over here to get stupid. And,
I can understand.
Yeah, and I don't blame them. I completely understand. And it was, we had a good relationship with the police department most of the time. There was Scott Evers, was a patrolman back then. He later became, I don't know how far he went in the department, but pretty far. He just recently retired. And there was him and, gosh, I can't remember all the other names, but they had a real good relationship with us, and they knew we would try to talk people out the door rather than beat them up and throw them out the door. Because that's at the granary, they had a bunch of thick neck wrestler jocks in there, and they liked to fight and beat people up.
What happened to the granary?
They just ran their course, and you know, it just started slowing down for him. And I think he had probably made enough money to last him a long time. And
were they also a music venue?
Yes, okay. They were, and they were real popular. As a matter of fact, it was funny when I worked during the time the granary was there, was when I worked at Rico's, and on Thursday nights we were dead, and the granary was packed. Okay. So the bouncers, we'd go out there and party and get in fights with the bouncers from the granary for entertainment. And so it was pretty crazy. But they, yeah, I don't know what was the final straw with them, but I think Chuck Morris, the guy that owned it, I think he just had enough, and you know, he had it for quite a while, and it was a legend. The Greenery was really it was one of the biggest main nightclubs in the whole St. Louis area. It was really a real popular place, and you know, we wanted to get in on their, you know, their reputation and stuff. Well, not on their reputation, but their popularity.
Were they bringing in the same type of music as you?
Yeah, okay. A lot of the same. You know, in the music business at that time, there would always be like five really hot bands, and you had to have them, okay. You know, to keep your, because back then people would travel long distances to follow a certain band. They just don't do that much anymore because of the drunk driving laws and all that, okay. which eventually put the end to Fat Cats.
Okay. And was it a smooth transition from the Greenery into Fat Cats?
Oh, yes.
Just kind of was 1 week it was the Greenery?
No, they were closed for a little while. I don't know how many months they were closed before we took over.
And you guys picked Fat Cats as the name? Because.
Yeah, they were, my partner was sitting around, him and his wife and a couple friends, probably enjoying some alcoholic beverages and things at the time, and they had a cat called Fats, and it was a giant cat. It was just enormous cat, and they said something, Sherry, Lou's wife, said something about, "You fat cat," and everybody went, "Fat cat? Wow."
That's it.
they were all over that, and you know, it just stuck, and we came up with a really cool looking logo that everybody liked, and so that helped sell t-shirts and jackets and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. So describe me, what was one of your best memories of Fat Cats? What was something that when you think about it, it just pops in your brain?
We used to have these all day, we'd have an anniversary party every year.
Okay.
Which the grand opening, we did it on the same day as the grand opening, the first week of August every year, we would do a anniversary thing. And we had Mama's Pride, which was a big act in St. Louis.
Mr. Liston, right?
Yeah, Pat Liston and Danny Liston and them. And I had been friends with them for a long time. They played there. A country group that was big back in the day when there was not really much country music going on, and there was a group called Errol Memphis, and they played a group called Faustus, which was probably the best cover band that's ever been in the St. Louis area.
And were they just randomly cover, or were they dedicated to a certain band?
No, they did everything. They did a lot of stuff other people couldn't cover. They did Bohemian Rhapsody, which Queen doesn't even do live without taped vocals and stuff, and they used to pull that song off.
Wow, that's some talent.
That's a tough song to pull off, and you know, these guys, like I said, it was Danny and Larry Hagley were the two brothers that started the band, and they were just, you know, they did like David Bowie, Genesis, that type of music, a little more complicated than three chord bang your head rock, and they were always a giant draw.
Okay.
Giant draw.
So they were sell out every night, kind of.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and then same was with Mama's Pride and the other ones, but when you put them all together for an all day long party, it was epic.
You guys did this like once a year?
Yeah, we did that once a year, and we just had, there were so many good times there. You know, we did a lot of, we worked real close with the radio stations. We used to go over and make our own commercials, and they did a lot of, KC did, and KWK at the time did a lot of big promotions with us and concerts. We had a group called Zebra, which was a big rock band in the early 80s, and the first, you know, venue in this place they ever played was Fat Cats, and they were promoting their album, and came in and about blew the doors off the place.
What was one of your hardest memories at Fat Cats? What's something that kind of sticks out?
God, just the the closing of it probably was the worst memory of it, because it was, you know, it was all kind of politically motivated, you know, they just kept putting the thumb on us harder and harder with the drunk driving laws, which I understand because it's a horrible thing. Yeah. And later on, I got a taste of it personally. My ex-wife and two kids were hit by a drunk driver.
Oh, that's terrible. I'm sorry.
And received really serious injuries, and the son ended up dying over his mental issues from the accident. And so it's, you know, I understand the importance, but they just kind of cherry-picked certain places and picked on them, and, you know.
You guys one of the larger?
Yeah, we were one of the larger clubs in the area. Okay. And so we were a good target, you know. So, and I get it, but it was sad because we also, you know, we also did stuff for the community, did benefits and stuff like that. And, when, you know, we wanted to show them that, you know, we may be crazy rock and roll rollers, but we still care, you know.
Wanted to give back a little bit. So did that happen really fast? Like, kind of, they started coming down the lawn within a month. It was like,
yeah, it was about probably about a year, I guess. It just started getting worse and worse, and it was, people were just afraid to come there, you know. And okay. So it just fizzled out. And then we had a guy that was going to put some money into the club and become a partner and do some big promotions, and he was one of those that was dreaming, and it never happened. So we ended up having to shut down.
Oh. So. And today it is where the Planet Fitness is,
right? No, it's where Quick Trip is.
It's where Quick Trip is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there used to be railroad tracks right there by where Lowe's or Home Depot is.
Okay.
There used to be railroad tracks that went through right about in the middle of that place, I guess.
Okay.
And we were on the other side of the tracks.
Now, I have to imagine that you guys were a big draw for the college, right? The college had been around at that point for about 20 or 30 years, right?
Yeah. And we had we'd have, you know, special nights where they got in free with a student ID and stuff like that.
Did you pull a lot of musical talent from the campus?
Not a whole lot, really. Yeah. And I don't know why. It was, you know, we were using, like I said, all the top groups in the St. Louis area, and there just wasn't much coming out of there.
Okay.
You know, as far as rock bands in the area.
So once Fat Cats closed because of all the issues, what did you think about opening another club? Were you wanting to... Where'd you go from there?
Well, we had talked about it, and we're going to do it, and then I think we were both just really burnt out, probably on each other and the business, and I did nothing for about a year, because the hours you work when you've got a nightclub is just, you're there, it's all 24/7, you're always there, you're always working, and I took off about a year, and then a guy that I used to book bands through, Ike Heisler out of Collinsville, talked me into coming to work for him.
Okay.
And I started out, I was managing a group called USA, who were guys out of some of the top bands around here that they had got together, and they were really talented, but not real smart. And so I got involved with them and said, hey, give me 3 or 4 months and see if I can get your money up. If I do, pay me.
Okay.
And within about a month, they started paying me, and they grew into a really popular band.
Is that still under the umbrella of Heisler?
Yes. Okay. Yes, they were working for Heisler, and that's how I kind of got the first time I met Ike, the booking agencies used to be really dishonest.
Okay.
And they would book, like I was talking earlier, Faustus was a great band, a great draw. They would book Faustus into 3 different clubs, and then the week before they'd call and say, oh my god, we messed this up, we're gonna have to move your date, and then that way they could put one of their crappy bands in there.
Oh, so they snuck bands in that way.
That's
oh,
how they did
that's
it.
Sneaky. And, that's
and I went up there, I was ready to go and punch him in the nose, and I went up there really pissed off and went in, and within about 20 minutes, we were friends, and I left patting each other on the back. I don't know how he did it, but he was a great bullshit artist. And he got me turned around, and we became really good friends, and are still friends to this day. And so, yeah, it was interesting.
How long were you there for?
I was with Ike for, I'm thinking about 2 years. And like I said, the thing, the dishonest stuff that went on, I told him as soon as I started, I said, you can do this without lying to people. It can be done. And it was funny because there was three major agencies in St. Louis at the time. There was Buckman Productions, there was Heisler Productions, and then there was Contemporary, which their local strand of their business was called Continental.
Okay.
And it was funny because everybody thought they were in competition, but every day all three of them were on conference calls all day talking about how they were going to screw somebody. And I told them, I said, I'm not doing this. And they all laughed at me and they said, oh, you'll get over that honest shit. Don't worry, you'll get over it. Well, I never did. And I left Ike's and started Swain Productions and pretty much ran all them out of business.
Really?
And, yeah.
So it was just the dishonesty of the business, yeah, as far as taking advantage of venues?
Yeah, they took advantage of the venues and the bands. They decided who could play and who couldn't play. And it was all, you know, a lot of the wrong motivations. And I just, you know, being a club owner, I knew what that felt like from that side. And then working with a band and managing a band, I knew what it felt from their side, too. And so, you know, and it took a while to... Because these clubs were, it's just like my job now, I sell cars. And people look at you, the first thing they think is, this guy's a crook. You know, right off the bat, you're a crook. And that was the same way with the booking agent. You know, they automatically classified you as dishonest. But I would spend a lot of time with the club owners, going in there and hanging with them and just letting them know that I was on their side and, you know, that we could do this together and be successful. Everybody could be more successful.
Okay.
And it, you know, over a couple of years' time, I had the exclusive booking agreements with quite a few of the clubs all around the St. Louis area. And so it kind of got to be, you know, where if you wanted to play in St. Louis, you had to, you know, in the St. Louis area, Madison County area, you had to go through me because I had most of the good clubs I was booking. And it was rough at first. You know, the other agents got their feathers ruffled and didn't want to.
So they weren't very happy that you went out and started this and that you were fomenting these relationships. That were they feeling like you were on their territory and you needed to get off?
Oh, yeah. I was a newcomer that, you know, they didn't care for what I was doing because it was eliminating their bullshit. But it worked great, you know. It was, I enjoyed that so much because we, you know, everybody made money, everybody was happy, we had some good times, and it was, you know, we did a whole lot of benefits and stuff like that and gave back and just tried to prove to people that, you know, we are idiots, but we're nice idiots.
So if you could say your mission statement for Swain Productions, what would that be?
Well, just honesty and have fun. Okay. It's always my, like, right now, what I do with Swain Productions, I tell everybody, every band that I work with, I said, if this isn't fun, I'm not doing it. Okay. If this becomes a thing where I have to have a little pissing contest with you, see ya. Because okay. I do this now because I want to, not because I have to.
Okay, absolutely.
And so it's kind of one of those things where, you know, and for the most part, it works great. You know, if you just keep that in mind of this has got to be fun and, you know, no need to deceive people or pull any crap. You know, just go out and put on the best shows possible. I like to work close with the bands and, you know, make sure they're doing everything they can on their end to make it better for the crowd.
Absolutely. And
because the people I used to get on bands that would, you know, if there was only 50 people in the club, they wanted to screw off and clown around. And I said, hey, look, these 50 people paid to see a show.
Yeah.
So I don't care if there's one of them there. Give them the show. You know, you want to act goofy, do it afterwards. And, you know, so it was, and it was funny because one of my bands was called Broken Toys. They later went on to get a record deal as King of the Hill.
Okay.
And when they were out touring with Extreme and bands like that, they all said, man, you guys are so polished and everything. How'd you? And they said, well, the guy we worked for would work us like 28 days in a row without a day off. And he'd show up most of the time making sure we were doing what we were supposed to be doing. And it, you know, it paid off for him. And they had an edge on a lot of bands they played with because they were, you know, they had went out and did the work and took it serious. And it was good to see it happen. They had a couple of videos on MTV and it was real back when they used to have videos on MTV. They used to actually play music on music television.
When you started Swaying Productions, you said the first couple of years were difficult?
Well, they weren't real difficult, but it took a while to get everything built up because I had two other agencies coming after me, you know, trying to trip me up everywhere.
What would that look like?
Well, they would try to block me in clubs, and they would try and, you know, they were trying to do what I was doing, but it wasn't working for them, so they weren't happy. And so they had some bands, and then one by one, they just started dropping off and coming with me. And the Buckman, he voluntarily got out. He wanted to go to California, so he took off. Continental, not so much. I used to have a letter from their lawyers I had framed hanging up in my office of them threatening to sue me.
Really?
Yeah. For torturous interference of contract and
really?
Yeah, you know, stuff like that. They were, you know, they thought I was a gangster or something. They thought I had heavies out there getting all this. And, you know, I don't know what they thought, but they, you know, said I was saying bad things about them. And I just, a lot of my clubs that were, it would cause problems when, if they would have been honest about everything, we could work together. And, you know, I've worked with a ton of agencies, like out of town agencies and stuff, would book through me and I'd book them in the clubs and okay. It worked great. They made a little less money, but they got into places and it was, you know, it was fair, but they didn't particularly like that. And, but I had a lot of clubs that I just made an agreement with of, I'll give you all the best bands that I got and, you know, take care of you, but I want to book your club exclusively.
Okay.
And I'll get you anybody you want, but you just book it through me.
Now, was that something that the clubs were interested in? Because it just made mainstream things, like, made it a little easier for them?
Yeah, it was. They just had me to deal with. And they, you know, and most of them by that time knew I wasn't going to lie to them and that I had great bands and and that I actually followed up all the time. I was out six nights a week, you know, five different clubs a night, checking on things and making sure everybody was doing what they're supposed to do.
Working as hard as the bands were.
And the other agents, they would, you know, a lot of them never even seen them in person before. Okay. Like Ike Heisler, he was one of the biggest ever and most bands didn't even know what he looked like because he'd never go see him, you know.
So one of the charms for Swaying Productions was you were right there, very accessible.
Yeah, very, very hands-on with everything, with the clubs and the bands.
Now, you created a band, too, I read, within Swaying Productions. I think was it a Ted Nugent cover band?
Or kind of Silver Bullet. Bob Seger one. I kind of got out of everything for a while. And, I guess, let's see, it was about 20 years ago, I got married for the third time, and I thought, maybe I ought to get out of that business, so I'll stay married more than 5 or 6 years.
Had a lot to do with...
Oh, yeah, I was a wild maniac, and the women, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know, I specialized in all of them, and so I kind of got out and was just doing a few things part-time, and... But I, you know, you can't get it out of you. Once you have that in you, it just tugged at me all the time. And so a real good friend of mine, one of my best friends, he could sing exactly like Bob Seger. I mean, he sounds just like him. He was only in one band for most of his life, and he was just a bass player. He was never a lead singer.
Okay.
I kept trying to talk him into doing this, and he was scared to death. He'd only played with those certain guys. I said, just let me put a band together for you. We'll get together and play about six songs and see if it gels, you know. And so there was a band I was booking occasionally called Arbogast. had some great players in it. I mean, these guys.
And were they veterans. From Madison County too?
No, they were. Let's see, where was all those guys from? There was, well, the drummer was actually from Madison County, Greg Bishop, okay. who is a guy that would be a great person. I don't know if you've seen his website, STLMusicYesterdays.com.
He'd be a good, another good interview too.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay. Great one. He has compiled such a collection of all the bands, the clubs.
Is he the one that runs the website that has the different clubs in St. Louis?
Yeah.
And you can get the pictures? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's okay. Greg. He's the drummer in that band.
Okay.
And me and him have been friends for 30 years or whatever. And he was kind of my friend in that band. And, you know, we got started and it was kind of funny because none of them wanted to do it. They all said, oh, that's not going to work. And we don't really care that much for Bob Seger. And I said, well, I think this will work. He's got a lot of hit songs. And so they got together and rehearsed a few songs. And then I took Steve out, the singer, to one of their jobs and had him sit in with the band and do it. And the response was just insane.
It was just massive.
Yeah, they just go crazy over him. And they've been together now about 5 years, I guess.
Okay.
And it's funny, up north, up around Chicago, there's a city up there, Ottawa, that... I mean, they drag in 7,000 people for a show up there.
Really?
I don't know if it's because it's close to Michigan or what it is, yeah. But they just love them up there. And
so that was a band you started managing after you took like a hiatus.
Right.
Right. So I want to jump really back before the hiatus. So what drove you? Was it just the overworking that got you into the hiatus from swing production?
No, just wanting to stay married and get myself
away. Your family.
Yeah. I thought, let's try it this way this time. And I quit drinking and drugging and all that crap that I was doing because it was just, you know, you get to the point where this is no fun anymore. And I was a serious drug addict for about 7 years, freebasing cocaine like a maniac, and thought I was a rock star.
Is that a big problem here in Madison?
Yeah, it was at the time. Now it's all heroin is the problem now, which is even worse, I think.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was one of those things where cocaine opened a lot of doors for you in the music business. You know, if you had all that, you could go talk to the guys in Fleetwood Mac or whoever happened to be in town that day.
Come on,
you know. And so it was stupid, but it was just part of the times. And, you know, I finally figured out I wasn't going to live if I kept doing that. So I cleaned my act up and I just wanted to stay away from the environment for a while. I'd actually quit drinking and was still out working in clubs and drinking seltzer water for quite a while.
That must have been difficult.
Well, you know what? It was actually, it was kind of weird because I've been addicted to just about everything you can be addicted to. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, if I get pissed off, you know, I was freebasing 2 ounces of cocaine a week.
Jesus.
And quit.
Just like that.
By myself.
Wow, no. Rehab, nope. That's awful.
And I'd been to rehab before, and I went straight from rehab to my buddy's house to get some weed. It didn't work well with me, but I was able to do it. And it's kind of funny because I always think God must have had a hand over me because all of the things I did that were so ridiculously stupid and dangerous, and I've been shot, I've been stabbed, I've been run over by a car, you know.
Holy cow.
A lot of crazy stuff. And, you know, I always made it through. I never went to prison, which I should have, because I was doing a lot of things I shouldn't have been doing. Should have been dead several times. I would OD on the stuff and have seizures and just was insane. And, you know, I found that's how I ended up dealing with music in church was... you know, after I quit doing it all, then I started thinking, well, wait a minute, man, this is still screwed up. You know, I'm straight now, but there's still something missing. And I accidentally ended up in church.
So that,
and of course, I wanted to change them too.
So was that kind of a spiritual conversion that happened?
Yeah, it was. It was kind of a funny thing because the music was such a... It was funny how music can just... is involved in everything that I do practically because I had a friend and you may want to cut this out. I don't know. But it was one Wednesday night, a friend of mine called and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm sitting on my ass watching TV, enjoying the quiet." And he goes, "Well, where's your wife and kids?" I said, "They're at church." And he said, "Well, why aren't you there?" I said, "Did you hear what I said? I'm at home sitting on my ass enjoying the quiet. I said, why would I want to go there?" And this guy goes, "That's bullshit." And then he started making these Bible quotes and he said, "You're the leader of the family. What kind of example are you setting?" And he was a friend that usually goes along with everything you said. But I was like, what the hell? And he kept saying it over and over. Bullshit. All that whole week, this is the weirdest thing ever, was I didn't keep hearing the Bible quotes over and over. I kept hearing bullshit over and over.
Like a broken record.
Like a broken record in my head.
Wow.
And the following Wednesday, it was funny because we were sitting at the table here eating. And I said, "I'm going to church with you guys tonight." And they all freaked out. They're like, "What are you going to do? Make some kind of scene or something? You don't know. We don't want you going." I said, "No, I want to go check it out." I walked in that place and it was during their praise and worship and people had their hands in the air and they were playing this music and I thought, oh my God, what a mistake I've made. I can't handle these people. They're freaks. And the music is horrible. You know, I was thinking, God, I can't stand this music. And I was about ready to turn around and walk out and I stayed. And then the pastor, Darren Karstens, come out and started talking. And just had an immediate connection. And gosh, like 2 weeks later, I was there running sound for him. And he asked me about, you know, "What do you think of the band?" And I just kind of smiled. And he said, "No, really, what do you think about the band?" I said, "Well, they kind of suck." And he goes, "Well, you think you could fix them?" Because actually, Darren had been a customer at Fat Cats.
Okay.
He knew my name from Fat Cats and knew that I was in the business and stuff. And so, you know, I started working with the bands and then we just became real close and I ended up being their director of corporate worship. They were trying to open another campus in O'Fallon, Illinois at the time. And so we went around and it was like a one night stand. I put a band together and we'd go set up and play church on Sundays at some banquet hall or something.
Now, did you pull from the bands that you knew or did you pull from the congregation?
No. Well, there was one guy in the congregation. The rest of them just had auditions and found these guys. Put ads on social media and stuff. And we found these guys. And, you know, it was... these guys were good because every week I'd make them learn like 5 songs every week. They come
in. That's a hefty for a band.
Yeah.
I played them one or two, and that's...
Yeah, I had 5 songs a week, and we'd come in about 2 hours before the service and run through the songs and get them done. And these guys said, there was one guy in particular, a keyboard player, he said, "You stretched me further than anybody ever has." He said, I was like, hell no, I can't learn 5 songs and get them together. But they did, and they were...
How'd you pick the songs?
I would try and find out what his message was. And I tried to find songs that kind of went along with that. And something interesting that I did was during the time I was doing this was every week I picked out a secular song that would go along with the message. And I thought it was a good idea because I remember that feeling I had when I walked in and heard that shitty music and wanted to leave. And I thought, you know, because when you walk in church, you know, like me, I hadn't been there in my life. You know, I was like 50 years old when I walked in there. And, you know, I always thought if they heard a song they could actually relate to, it would relax them a little bit and say, oh, hey, these guys aren't so bad.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, we would... to have songs like "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow" or, you know, just songs like that that had a good message.
Uplifting,
that,
positive.
Yeah. And I think it really helped a lot of people. A lot of people used to comment on it. That really was great.
Have you seen the congregation grow since then?
Oh, yeah. It's grown quite
a bit. How long ago was this that you started this?
God, when did we start doing it? Probably six or 7 years ago, I'm guessing. I'm really bad with time. But they got, when I started in the, you know, I worked there ever, you know, running sound for the bands and doing the thing in the O'Fallon campus. And then I got in the car business 5 years ago and that kind of put the brakes on everything.
Okay.
because you work so many hours. I'm like 60 hours a week there, and then 20 hours a week with Swain Production. So there's not much time.
Are you the only one working in Swain Production?
Yes.
Like it's
all me right now. So it's a little, but you know, it's so much easier now with the technology. Because it used to be, I had to be in the clubs all the time, talking to them, being their friend, bringing them pictures and posters and all that. Now no one wants to talk to you. It's all text messages and emails, and send them electronic press kits, and you know, so I can do a lot.
Not so much legwork.
Right. Yeah. Okay. If I had to go out and I don't do a whole lot of nightclubs now. I mostly do places like the Wiley Theater and the amphitheaters around the area and stuff like that, and you know, outdoor summertime gigs and stuff like that, where, because I like this tribute band thing, is so nice, because the shows you put on, like in a bar, there's the main reason people are there is to pick up women or pick up guys or whatever they're into, and it's all about that, and they got screens all over the room with football games going on, and people are not really paying them that much attention to the band. You know, the band will be up there playing, they hear everybody cheering and think they did something, then you look over, it's making a touchdown, you know. And I just hate that. I hate that whole thing. That's, and it's gotten so bad over the years now.
So that's a big change you've seen.
Oh yeah, because it used to be your stage was up here and the lights were on the stage and there was no TVs around playing stuff, you know, and then it slowly came in a little bit at a time. Somebody having a TV over here and over there, and then, God, now you walk in a lot of clubs, there's TVs everywhere you look. And to me, it's so much more enjoyable for the bands. And most of my bands that do this, they're doing it because they want to, and it's, you know, they don't play all the time, because a tribute show, you can't play six nights a week, you know, because, you know, who wants to hear the same guy over and over again? And so, but the shows are shows, like at the Wildy is probably one of the best venues around.
This is perfect, because I wanted you to tell me about the Wildy.
The Wildy,
there's history there. This is
so cool. It's a great, I just had a concert there last Saturday.
Elton John
tribute. And it's such an awesome place, because it's a beautiful theater. Everybody's there sitting in a seat, faced at the stage, and they're there for music. They're not there to watch the football game or to try to pick somebody up, or, well, most of them aren't anyway. And it's kind of funny, too, because I was used to always being the oldest guy in the room. Mm-hmm. Not no more with these tribute bands. You have people from 18 to 80.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible. When I see people coming in walkers, and I'm like, holy cow. And then you see these young kids, and they're singing along with every song, and they weren't even born when these artists came out.
I'm a Grateful Dead fan. The past 10 years, proliferation of tribute bands to the Grateful Dead, Dark Star Orchestra obviously being the most famous.
Yep.
It's you get multi-generational.
Right.
And so by managing these cover bands, do you feel like you're introducing music to a new generation?
Yeah, well, you know, that's what I don't know, because like I said, these kids are singing the words of the song already, and it's like, what the hell, you know? And but it just goes to show, classic rock has such a longevity, and such a, you know, because you hear it in movies and stuff, you know, they're playing Guitar Hero, taught a lot of kids old songs, and there's a lot of young people that listen to classic rock. Okay. And it's very non-offensive, and you know, you can do family-oriented shows with,
absolutely,
you know, unless you're doing the Ozzy Osbourne tribute, you know, they gotta.
Really?
Yeah, real good friends of mine.
That must be interesting.
Yeah, they're old friends of mine that I've worked with for years, and they. You know, but you have to do the Ozzy routine and say fuck every other word. So it's kind of hard to put them in a lot of places. And but it's just, and these tribute bands, like the Bob Seger group, he sounds better than Bob Seger does.
Really?
Bob Seger. Because Bob can't hit the notes anymore. You know, he's had, you know, hell, he's like 70 or something. And, you know, he can't sing that high anymore. And it's funny, because we had a guy came out and seen Silver Bullet, the first show they ever did.
Was that at the Wildy?
No, it was at Pops, actually, over in Sauget. And this guy was an old friend of mine that played in a bunch of my bands back in the old days. And he's a college professor at Lewis and Clark College, music professor out there. And he seen the band. He said, man, if you ever need a keyboard player, he said, these guys are great. He said, I just seen Bob Seger 2 weeks ago. He said, you guys sound a whole lot better than him.
Oh, and that's got to be one of the best compliments you can get, right?
It was great. And he ended up in the band. So he's in the band now. And he's also in the Elton John tribute.
Okay.
And there's a lot of guys. My guitar player and that Silver Bullet band is in probably 7 other tribute bands.
Is there a culture of that here in Madison County? Kind of like, it seems like you got a lot going on with that. So is there a lot of musicians here in Madison?
Oh, yeah. Like? Yeah, there's one, Red. They're all from Madison County. It's a Sammy Hagar tribute.
Okay.
There's just a lot of them out there now. And it's kind of cool because it's a lot of, you know, once I started doing the Silver Bullet thing, I started getting calls from all my old musician friends when they heard I was doing that. Okay. Well, we got a tribute band too, and you know, you got to come see us. And
it's like Pandora's box.
Yeah, I was like, man, I was just doing this for like a little hobby and something to do on the side, and then suddenly I got like 12 bands on
board. So was Silver Bullet the first tribute band? Is that were you thinking, is this going to work? Is this not going to work?
I always believed it would work.
Okay.
You know, I always believed because we did it right. We put 2 backup girl singers, a sax player, 8 people in the band. It really sounds exactly like Bob Seger.
Okay.
And you know, he's an artist that has over 2 hours worth of hit songs that everybody recognizes.
Yeah.
And that's the hard thing to find as an artist that has a couple hours of music that can keep people interested the whole time.
Okay.
Because some of these tributes, they have to get into the album cuts and the B-sides and stuff like that.
Kind of. We got one that's Tom Petty and Johnny Cash, right?
Yeah.
Which is
Petty Cash Junction.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought about it before, but now that I've thought about it, I can see how those wouldn't meld.
Yeah, right. And they did some kind of concert together before.
Okay.
And they are awesome. Great band. Guitar player from El Monstero is the guitar player in that band.
Okay.
And which is probably the most successful tribute band in St. Louis area is El Monstero.
Okay. I'll check them out.
They sell out 5 nights in a row every year at the pageant.
Really?
During December. Yeah.
Wow.
I think it's the day after Christmas, I think it starts usually.
Okay.
And they play for like a week and sell it out every night.
Right.
They play at Verizon or Hollywood Casino Amphitheater now.
Oh.
The place I used to call Riverport.
So what, with these bands a few years ago, you started reviving the benefit, the help concert, right?
Yeah.
Is that what it's called? And you pick a new...
What happened was years ago, it was in 85, I had this idea for a help concert. Okay. And I went to some friends. There was a guy from a group called Uriah Heep. Ken Hensley,
okay.
He was a big rock star back in the 70s,
okay.
That had moved to the area, and me and him and Ike Heisler, Kevin McCarthy, a DJ from the St. Louis area, we were the main ones that got it started, and we said, it'd be neat to do a benefit, and so I approached a guy that owned stages, Bill Benjamin, and I told him my idea. I said, I want to put on 10 bands in one night. And do a big benefit. And
wow.
At the time, I didn't even know what the benefit was going to be for.
You just wanted to do a benefit.
I just wanted to do one, just to try something like this. And, you know, kind of help the musician's image.
What year was this? What's that? What year was this?
85.
85, okay.
And so I talked to Bill Benjamin, who owned Stages, which was the biggest club around. And he said, well, God, that sounds like a great idea. He said, but there's no way you're going to pull it off. He said, you can't put 10 bands on in one night. And I said, I think I can. And he said,
ambitious.
He says, well, go ahead. He says, it's not going to work, but go ahead. And so we went around and got every radio station involved. KZK, 103, KC, who was else in there at the time? KWK still around? I don't know, but we got every major radio station involved in this. And so right before that, I had to come up with a charity. And it was really funny. I had first thought about doing something for abused kids. Well, I started researching, and every charity out there for abused kids was incorporated, which means they can use like 80% of the money for administrative fees.
Okay.
And I was like, no.
Kind of what the Red Cross got in trouble for.
Yeah.
A couple of years back.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I said, no, I'm not doing that. So I kept looking, and I thought, well, homeless people. So I called Larry Rice. He calls me back, and I told him the idea and what I was doing, and he said, I'd rather not be connected with people like you. I said, really? I said, what kind of people is that? He said, well, you're doing this in a bar with a bunch of rock and roll people, and it'll probably be lewd. And I said, yeah, some people will probably say, fuck. I said, but what's that got to do with anything? You know, they're trying to do some good and help you out. And he wasn't interested, so I don't remember what I told him.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So he didn't want to be associated with you guys because you guys were rock and rollers, right?
Yep. Huh. And I forgot what kind of colorful thing I said to him before I hung up, but I hung up and then got a hold of the St. Louis Area Food Bank, and they take every dollar and put it towards meals for people. Well, we did. We pulled this thing off, and I had got all the biggest cover bands in the St. Louis area, all 10 of them, wow. Had the best roadies in town. Had equipment off and on where our switchover time was like 10 minutes.
Was this hard to organize?
Oh, yeah.
Is it harder to organize a benefit show or a regular show?
Well, benefit show because everybody's working for free.
Okay.
But it's amazing how these guys in St. Louis get really involved in it and really work hard at it. When it's a benefit, they seem to work harder than they do when they're getting paid.
Okay.
And so me too. I work a hell of a lot harder when I'm working for free than I do when I'm getting paid. But we put this thing together. It was a huge success. I think I can't remember how much money, but it was thousands and thousands of meals and a truckload of food. And it was a great big thing. We went down to downtown St. Louis and marched down the road with the Help Concert banner and
oh, wow.
A bunch of long hairs. And we went into the studios. I think it was still KSLQ at the time. Was where Kevin McCarthy was working. And we went in, a few of us went in there and got on the radio and made the donation to the St. Louis Area Food Bank. And
okay.
So it was really cool. And then another thing that kind of got me back in the business before the tribute bands was there was someone, a guy named David Lewis, started a Facebook page called I Used to Party Out at Stages.
Okay.
Which sounded like a really dumb thing, but
I actually think I came across this website.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm an administrator on that now. And me and him have become real good friends. But I got on there and there was people chatting on there. And a couple guys that I knew, Darren Boyd and Adrian Vesper, were on there talking about it. And I chimed in. I said, we ought to do a reunion show with some of the old bands. And they both just started blasting me with, come on, you can do it, you're the man. And I hadn't done anything in 10 years at the time. And I was like, and I was driving a bus for Madison County ACT, the ones that pick up disabled people.
Okay.
So I'm working full time there. And these guys get me all jacked up. I think it was on vacation or something. And I said, hey, I can do it. And after I took it on, I thought, well, what the hell was I thinking? Because the one in 85, I had all these guys helping me. Mm-hmm. Well, this time, I had to do it all myself.
And this time you were bringing it to Edwardsville, right?
No, this one we did at the Pageant.
The Pageant, okay.
Yeah.
This is the first one you did it.
The first one was the Stages.
Okay.
It was the first one in 85. And then after the Haiti earthquake, we did the one, it was 2000, God, I can't even remember what year it was now.
And that was the, what was it, 2004? The Haiti earthquake, 2005?
I think so. I think it was around there, and I can't even remember. I'd have to look it up.
And that was at the Pageant?
Yeah, that one we did at the Pageant, and it was kind of funny because, you know, the first one, Larry Rice told me to take a hike. Well, this one, the church that I belonged to, Enjoy Church, which was called NTF at the time,
okay. They
sponsored it.
Okay.
And so it was kind of funny that, you know, I got told I was a devil before, and this time I had a church sponsoring the thing. And it was a big success. We put bands together that hadn't played together in 20 years, you know.
And so it was a joyful occasion for everybody.
Oh, it was so much fun. People, you couldn't wipe the smiles off people's faces. I had more fun that night. The all the old Stages employees showed up because we called it a Stages reunion. Okay. And all the old employees with their silk jackets showed up, and it was just a blast. And like I said, it was hard getting some of the groups together because they hadn't played together in 15, 20 years, yeah. And some of them didn't like each other anymore. But I just called in a lot of favors.
Oh,
and,
nice.
And I said, just do this, you know, and pulled it off, did the whole thing in like 28 days, I think.
That's it. Pulled that off that quickly.
Yeah.
That's off.
And most of it was all social media, you know. We pretty much advertised that a lot, but I did get some radio stations involved again, and they, you know, talked it up on the radio and everything. So it was and that was kind of what started me, and then the tribute, that was right before the tribute thing.
And this wasn't your even the 85 show wasn't your first really dive into benefit shows.
Oh no, I had done
Fat Cats. I read a story where you guys had surprised the nun.
Oh no, that was with at Granny's.
That was at Granny's.
Yeah.
Okay. We involved with that one?
It was great. We did as a matter of fact, tomorrow's my birthday. Oh, and it's also birthday. Pat Liston's birthday, guy from Mama's Pride. We're real good friends.
Okay.
Well, like three of the other guys in Mama's Pride had birthdays that week. So back in the Fat Cats days, my partner was crazy, and he used to get on there, put radio ads about Tom Swain's birthday bash. And he would make goofy comments about me and everything. Well, it became a really big, crazy party every year. Well, after Fat Cats closed, several years later, somebody was, man, you should do your birthday party again. And I was like, okay. And back then when we did it, it was just a regular night. And I thought, well, I don't want to, you know, it's my birthday. I feel weird about making money. So I'll turn it into a benefit. So we, the first one I did, I think was at Granny's in Alton. And we put on, I don't know, six bands or something like that night. And raised money, and we went down to the Alton Food Crisis Center, and there was a lady, Frances Jackson, who's passed away since, but she was the one that kind of ran the thing, and we went down there and gave her a check, and I don't remember the exact, it seems like 7,000 or something like, it was quite a bit of money, and a lot of food, and she was just crying, and it was really cool, and I got so mad at the newspapers around here because I wrote a pretty shitty letter to them. When they were working on shutting Granny's rocker down.
Well, the papers were?
Well, they went along. It was MAD, the Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Okay, yeah.
One of the ladies in there had a nephew, I believe it was, who was at Granny's rocker early in the night. They had a thing, a barber chair there, or dentist chair or something. And they had this scam where they would put you in the chair and lay you back, and they put a funnel in your mouth and poured some liquor in your mouth and spun you around in circles. And if you survived, you got a t-shirt. And it was really, actually, it was kind of a scam because there wasn't that much alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, they just get dizzy from spinning around. Well, this guy was there and did it and got a t-shirt. Well, he went to like five other clubs. And sometime after midnight, he went to the police impound, got somebody else's motorcycle, I don't know how he ever did it, and was driving down Broadway in Alton on the wrong side of the road and got killed.
Oh.
And his sister placed the blame on Granny's rocker because he had that t-shirt with him. And she just was incredible. She apparently had some kind of political power around here. Because she was on every time anything happened at Granny's, if the police were called to get rid of a minor or something, it was in the papers, and she was had her nose in there griping, and I wrote him a big letter, and I said, you know, it's really ignorant that you know, you want to report on anything that happens there. But when we go and do benefit, and we did quite a few benefits there, they never wanted to report on those.
So it was very just unfair report.
Right.
Just...
Yeah, it was really bad. And they finally, it was funny because they finally published one of my letters to the editor later on after they were already closed down. They published it. And I thought, well, that was really nice. And it was just ignorant. It was just totally ignorant the way they did that. And, you know, they, I just thought it was unfair.
Yeah. So the benefit shows, you had some experience in the 80s with them. Then you brought it back at the pageant in, in mid-2000s, 2004, right. 2005. And then that went off wonderfully.
Yeah.
Did you, at that point, were you like, well, let's do this every year?
Yeah.
Or did someone have to come along and be like, hey, well, let's do that again?
Yeah, well, we've done a few others since. We do one at the train wreck every August with the Seeger group and Elton John group. And this year was a Journey tribute also for the Rock for Relay for the Cancer Association.
Okay.
We do that every year. 103.3 sponsors it, and we do a big thing. And we're gonna be doing something around here soon too, because everybody's.
So have you done one every year? Has it been an annual thing?
No, it hasn't been annual.
Okay.
It used to be with the birthday party. It became kind of a joke because it was my annual 30th birthday.
Oh, okay,
party.
Maybe that's what I was getting confused on.
Yeah,
okay.
Then it was the third annual 30th birthday. And I think we got up to like 7 or 8, something like
wow.
that we did every year. Yeah. You know, we did them a lot. And it was, and the club owners loved it because they knew they were going to sell a lot of drinks that night.
Yeah, I imagine, yeah.
And it's always been pretty successful. And, we did it up in Edwardsville too, and okay. So.
Are you seeing a revival of music here, or is it from what it was in the 80s? Because it sounds like you guys had a real nice, vibrant hopping scene in the 70s and 80s. It kind of fell off. The drunk driving, the clubs closing down. You kind of seem like you had your finger on the pulse, right? Are you seeing a revival in it? Are you trying to work with the Wiley to get more going on?
Yeah, I do a series at the Wiley every year, a tribute series.
Okay.
And, you know, it's usually 8 or 10 shows a year there. And I'm working on some ideas for a benefit right now that I can't really say because it's not all together yet. But
absolutely.
It's probably going to be there. I can say that much. And, you know, we want to start doing some stuff in the summer. It's really hard because everybody's so busy in the tribute world. That's when you work the most is all these outdoor events and stuff. And so wintertime, it slows down, and that's when we got more time to do stuff like that.
Okay.
So, we're going to do some of that. And, it's really weird because I don't think the music scene will ever get back to what it used to be.
Okay.
You know, because there used to be, gosh, I would have in the heyday, I would have 12 or 15 bands playing every Friday and Saturday night. And like Wednesday and Thursday, probably 5 or 10. And then, you know, a couple on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. You know, so there was a lot of venues and a lot
going on.
You know, you could make a living playing music then.
Wow.
And now, not that many people make a living at it anymore. There are some out there that do, but not a whole lot.
And do you think that has to do with just the change of the culture in Edwardsville or Madison County?
No, it's everywhere.
It's everywhere?
It's everywhere. It's just not... Well, like, you need a big club to support big bands, you know, it's all kind of changed now to a lot of duos and acoustic acts and small bands that just go in, like, over here, Wigglers and Laurie's Place and small rooms like that, and they play. And it's just not they only do bands on the weekends. Not hardly anybody does them during the week anymore. There's a few, but not much, but... It's just a lack of work and being able to, you know, it seems like from what a lot of people told me after I got out of the booking business, that there's a couple of guys that came in and tried to take over and do stuff. And there's one guy out there that's fairly successful, Dave Cowles. He's a friend. He plays in the Petty Cash Junction. He's also has an agency.
Okay.
And they just got to where there were so many independent bands out there, and they just drove their money down because, you know, they said, well, we'll play for 600, you know, and well, we'll play for 500. They worked themselves right out of work by, you know, lowering all the prices and not getting the money they used to get. So it was tough on the, you know, musicians had to go get jobs and be happy with playing on the weekends,
yeah,
you know, because it just, they all had to eat and they were all growing up. And it's kind of funny because the era of musicians that I came up with are still playing. You know, they're out there playing. And there's a few of them, like I said, the Well Hungarians, Dr. Zhivago, some of those groups are making a living playing. You know, so there are some out there. But all the rest that are playing part-time and stuff are the same guys that were playing 30 years ago. They're still out there playing, and which is great, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's awesome. And I wish there was more places for them to play, but it's, you know, it's just one of them things. You got to go with the times. And
absolutely. Before we wrap up, is there anything you want to add to the interview that I didn't touch on? Is there anything you want to elaborate on? Anything like that?
No, just support live music as much as you can. You know, that's the most important thing. That's probably the most important part is when you see a band somewhere, sit down and watch them. Pay attention to the band a little bit, and you know, we've got extremely talented musicians in this area. Madison County's has tons of great musicians, and like I said, it's always been, Madison County's always been vibrant nightlife for years and years, and like I said, now there's not so much of it, but what's out there, if everybody supports it, maybe it'll turn around someday. I don't know.
Awesome.
You know.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right.